this is our outline for the Bible we've been using. Friends of mine, Bob and Sandra Waldron, put this together years ago, and it's just been helpful to me. Before the flood, scattering of the people, the patriarchs, the Exodus, wandering in the wilderness, invasion and conquest, judges,
united kingdom, divided kingdom,
Judah alone, captivity, return, years of silence, life of Christ, early church, letters to the Christians. I'm glad you started saying it. So even if you're just reading it and saying it, you're also hearing it now. So just that cross-layering of senses. Knowing this story, it helps us so much because just in reading it, we go, okay, where am I? What's going on? What are the rules? But then how does that point to Jesus? And then how do I see myself furthering that story? That's all part of this. This is living word. We are in the period of the judges, so what's kind of the main theme, what's really happening during the period of the judges?
They're abandoning God.
Yes, an abandoning, right, because it's an ongoing process. What does that abandoning look like? What are some of the things that you notice? Amos?
Idolatry.
Yeah, idolatry is kind of the main thing, right, is they're turning to idols because they have forgotten God. Generation arose that did not know Joshua, did not know the elders, and destroyed for lack of knowledge. So these people are forgetting the Lord. What else? You think about the judges. Yes? I'm sorry? Go ahead, Titus. I'm sorry. Yes. So God rescues, they cry out, so it's kind of a cycle, right? They forget God, and they cry out to God for deliverance. He sends them a deliverer. We use the word judge, the Bible uses that word, but he's a teacher, he gives judgment, but mostly the role is deliverance. And then they return to God, they're blessed again, forget God, and starts this whole cycle over again. Amy, you're going to say something.
I was thinking of the phrase, I couldn't tell if somebody said it already, but everyone did what was right in his own eyes.
Yes, I didn't hear it, but that's exactly right. That phrase shows up a few different times in Judges. In forgetting God and turning away from God, we have to make things up on our own. That's kind of the way it works. Consider this. Why is it wrong to steal? I heard
you wouldn't want anybody to steal from you.
Okay.
Something you wouldn't want somebody to do to you.
I wouldn't want somebody to steal from you.
Primary is
what
God said.
David?
Yeah, I mean, somebody, at least you assume that whatever that person has, something that belongs to them is something that they most likely value. Never mind, they value it, but you're taking something away that's not yours and you're doing it by unjust means, so you're disenfranchising yourself. You're disenfranchising someone else for your own personal gain.
Isn't that good? Personal gain? What's wrong with personal gain? If there is no God, what's wrong with me taking your stuff?
If there's no God, if there's no standard.
When is a lie a bad thing? Can you think of times where lying is maybe kind? Or modest is like, no, she's right. But aren't there times you're tempted, trying to think of a nice thing to say to somebody, they've asked your opinion on something, and you go, I wouldn't say that exactly, but, how do you navigate that? I didn't say what question was asked of it. So how do you, is a lie, why is it wrong? Amos?
Well, it's something that they worked for and you taking it from them, it's something that they worked hard to get.
Sure, but I worked hard to steal it. Ethan?
I think, God's commanded us to love our neighbors, so the doing things like lying that pain you from loving your neighbor kind of agree with what you said before. If we did live in a universe where there wasn't a God, you know, like what? Like we're all just going to die anyway. Like what? Why does it matter if you treat them nicely?
Noah?
The bottom line is God has drawn the line. He says it's wrong. That's the bottom line.
Isn't that the basis of morality?
Yes.
If there is no God, try to explain why certain things are right and certain things are wrong. You can't. It's always personal, it's always subjective. You might say, well, it's for the greater good of our community. Who cares about the community when I've got personal desires and personal needs? And aren't we willing to sacrifice the needs of the greater good and the personal, you know, our neighbor's personal well-being for our own at times? And yet, we know deep down it's wrong to be a coward. We know it's wrong to lie. We know it's wrong to break our word. The question is why? So the book of Judges is painting a picture of a time when everyone's doing what's right in their own eyes. They've forgotten God, and there's no king in Israel to say, here's the rule. Now the fact is, and I think Alex pointed this out a few weeks ago, there's always been a king in Israel. And his name is Yahweh. But what will help the people is God often works through representatives. And so he's going to send a king to lead the people. But the king they call for, the king they want, is somebody like themselves. Someone who's going to make it up and serve themselves, and it's going to tear them further apart. So we need a king. Judges is crying out for a king. And ultimately that king, his name is
Jesus.
Jesus. We're looking for the Messiah who will shepherd us, who will lead us, who will provide and protect us. So that's kind of what we're looking at in this book of Judges. This study in Judges 9 through 10 is going to be a great case study in that idea. Okay, David, you look like you have... All right. Some of you look like you're thinking, which is great. You just got talking them out. Thoughts or questions? All right, let's look at Judges 9 through 10 then. Here, the judges so far, Othniel, Ehud, Shamgar, Deborah, there's a song. But we're in Abimelech. Abimelech is not a judge, okay? But he is a major story in this period, so we're going to focus in on him. He is the first king in Israel. Not the first king over Israel. He's only a king in Israel, over a portion of him. He's not a God-appointed king, but he becomes a king. And so he is, if you see a chart of all the kings, he's the one with the frowny face. Because he's a bad dude, okay? But honestly, you know, as we go along, there are going to be frowny faces on a lot of these people, okay? Ethan.
If I'm remembering my Hebrew correctly, the word Melech in Hebrew means king, right?
All right, let's talk about it. Yes.
It's something king. I think they were predicting his future when they named him.
Well, who named him Melech? Abimelech?
Gideon.
And Ab,
father.
And the I there means my. So like in Elijah, my God is Jehovah. That's what Elijah means. Elisha, my God is salvation. Right? And Ab in Melech is my father is king. And so Gideon, no, I couldn't be king. And my sons, we wouldn't be king. And then he names this guy, My dad is king, which is quite the power play. Now, where does Abimelech come from? He's not just a son of Gideon. How does that work out in their family? Amos?
Isn't there also Melchizedek?
Yes, there's Melchizedek. That's right. So he is king of righteousness. You have Zedekiah, the righteousness of the Lord. So you have different names like that. So, the question was, where does Abimelech come from? He's Gideon's son, but how does all that work out?
Mother's from Shechem.
Okay, she's from Shechem. Is she one of Gideon's wives? What's going on here? Because he's got quite a few sons. How many sons does he have?
70
sons. So he's married multiple times. And this fella... He's kind of like I love the look on Diane's face right now. I'm sorry. She's like, oh, I know this is a bad idea. And she's right. She's exactly right. Never in the Old Testament never in the Bible does someone get married to multiple wives and it, like, well, that's a really positive example. I think we'll try that. Like, never. But here, lots of sons. Why is he going to all the trouble to have lots of sons? Ethan? So I'm not a king, but he's kind of setting himself up like ruler, Gideon is. Now, Abimelech comes from this mother of Shechem, and she, being from, what's significant about Shechem? Do you remember? You have to go all the way back to Genesis 34.
That's where Abraham bought Beriah, and Beriah buried Sarah, and
God. Yes, yes. Also significant there, the city itself.
That's where Dina's brothers, I forget which ones, Jacob's sons go
and slay everybody. Yeah, so Dinah, the sole daughter of Jacob, Leah's daughter, again, multiple wives, she goes to Shechem there. So this city has some history here. Now, Abimelech, he and his mother are kind of rejected by these other brothers. There are the 70 and there's the one. And then he goes to Shechem and he says, look, let's get a posse together. And what do you say? Instead of having 70 rulers, you just have one. Why would you want 70 bosses when you could just have one? And they say, sounds good to us. And so how does Abimelech proceed? He kills the rest of Abimelech's family. Takes all the 70 sons, kills them on one stone, except for the youngest.
Jotham.
Pays to be little sometimes. You kind of sneak out of there. Just remember that. So Jotham, he sneaks out, and then he comes back, and Abimelech has made an agreement. In verse 4, they gave him 70 pieces of silver out of the house of Baal-Berith, with which Abimelech hired worthless and reckless fellows who followed him. So he's got a hired mob, and he's running around ruling over everything. Baal-Berith, the house of Baal-Berith. Now, later we'll see another house similar to this. What is that? What is the house of Baal-Berith?
It's a temple.
So they're building structures now, shrines and temples, in honor to these gods. Baal means Lord. So this is the Lord of Berith, the house of their god. And so there's this idolatrous interaction. Now, Jotham comes out, and in verse 7, he goes up on Mount Gerizim, and he tells a story. What's the story? It's like a parable, kind of like Jesus style here.
About victory and the...
All right, so let's look at all the story here. In verse 8, the trees once went out to anoint a king over them. Now, let's just make sure we're getting this straight here. Trees can't do this, okay? So what's the point with the trees?
They're representing the people.
Okay, yeah. Let's just make sure we get that right. Like, this is not agricultural science. He's not getting, like, this is, he's making a statement, and it's a, instead of just coming right out and saying it, it's illustrative, okay? Okay, yeah, symbolism, parable, that's the way it works. So the trees want to anoint a king. And so they go to the olive tree, reign over us. But the olive tree said to them, shall I leave my abundance by which gods and men are honored and go hold sway over the trees? And the trees said to the fig tree, you come and reign over us. But the fig tree said to them, shall I leave my sweetness and my good fruit and go hold sway over the trees? And the trees said to the vine, you come and reign over us. But the vine said to them, shall I leave my wine that cheers God and men and go hold sway over the trees? And then all the trees said to the bramble, you come and reign over us. And the bramble said to the trees, if in good faith you are anointing me king over you, then come and take refuge in my shade. But if not, let fire come out of the bramble and devour the cedars of Lebanon. All right, so the question is, I asked you question number 2, if you've got a study guide here, explain Jotham's parable and what applications do you see in your own life? So
What's the explanation of the parable? What's it getting at? The trees represent the people, the king. Well, that's the king. And who? So who's who? Yes.
Were you right to choose Abimelech as a king?
Okay. And so Abimelech is represented by?
The thorn.
The brambles, right? What is that? You said thorns.
It's a bush of thorns.
Catch fire.
Has anybody ever seen brambles? Like, we're in Philly, so I don't take this for granted here. You've seen this kind of thing, yeah?
Tumbleweed is what I'm thinking of.
Okay. We're looking at, if you try to go through the woods, and in the woods, around the low areas, you just got thorns that are growing up and around and over things, and you can't get through because they're going to catch everything and rip you up. It'll oftentimes leave your stickers in you, cut you to pieces. And so that's the bramble that we're talking about here. So the forest has like this low hedge kind of growing through it. So they first go to the olive tree. Now, why would you go to the olive tree?
Very useful, very fruitful.
Yeah, it's fruitful. It's got something to offer us. And it says, but I'm busy being productive. Vine. I'm busy being productive. I'm busy being fruitful. So they go to the bramble. What does the bramble produce? Nothing. And Elijah said it's only good for?
Amos
said it. Fire. It's only good for fire. You don't build houses with it. You can't make furniture out of it. I wouldn't recommend it. And so it's only good for fire. And so they say, will you rule over us? And he says, great. Unless you turn against me, and if you do, then the fire will come and consume. So Jotham is sort of predicting the outcome of all of this. If this was a good faith relationship, then God be with you. While he's also thinking about his dead brothers. He knows this is not a good faith relationship. So he knows this is all going to turn south. So thinking about applications. Are there any applications you can think of biblically, looking forward to Jesus through the cross, or just thinking about in your own life? David?
Well, I mean, I was thinking more so along the lines of pointing how this points to Jesus is Philippians 2, verses 5 through 8. It reads, let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus, who being in the form of God, thought it not robbery to be equal with God, but made himself no reputation, took upon him form of a servant, and was made in the likeness of men. Being found in fashion as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. So essentially, God being manifested in the human form of Jesus, you know, God leaves heaven and essentially is being manifested to Jesus, who experienced the vanity of this life, and ultimately the
back to this story? Perhaps so we can see how low and painful those things are. David?
Just thinking on a very practical level, but when you choose your master, there are consequences. And when we disregard the laws of God and choose the master of the devil, there are consequences. And, we seek after those things, but it's not the same as depending on the Lord.
Amen.
I'm pondering kind of a contrast between choosing to elevate and glorify that which is least productive, and then if you take both of those and make both of those opposite, using, well, either that or we can choose to destroy and despise that which is most productive and most valuable. Just kind of pondering.
Yeah.
That.
Yeah, in fact, there are laws God gave about not cutting down the fruit trees of the land, that kind of thing. But yeah, we do elevate insignificant, foolish things in this world. Kind of coming back to David's point, Jesus talked about you can't serve two masters. So you got to choose. So what kind of master is going to be a good one? Interestingly, when the crowd came to Jesus in John chapter 6, they wanted to force him to become king. Abimelech would love that. Jesus, because he sees it's happening for the wrong reason. Jesus wants to be king, but on his terms. And so to come to him and to force him to be what we would make him, that's going to be a very twisted, terrible, insignificant, inefficient relationship. But to come to him on his terms, that's a beautiful thing. This has all the markings of destruction. It's coming. Ethan, you have a thought?
I guess I see what you're saying. I was going to say I'm not sure I see the connection to Jesus. The point of this story is, you know, the brambles aren't going to make a good king. Like, the brambles are a fire hazard. And so he's basically saying, you make Abimelech your king and burn your kingdom to hell.
Yeah.
So, and obviously, like, that's not what we would say about Jesus being king. We would say the opposite, that Jesus is the king.
And sometimes that's all we need. And sometimes in looking at these stories and passages, we see how desperately we need Jesus as king. I mean, who can rightly say, my father is king? Of course, Jesus is king. Abimelech comes in, and he's ruling for his own selfish motives. And to go back to Philippians 2, what David pointed out, when Jesus rules, he lays everything down for the sake of his people. So what kind of king are you going to choose? These people paid money to have this guy as their king. He's going to tear them apart. They're going to destroy each other. Jesus laid down his life to save us, worthless as we are, and then offers to give us an eternal inheritance. I mean, think about it. And don't we want someone to rule over us? We want someone to protect us and provide for us. Look at this king. Look at Philippians 2. So I think there's some really significant connections, maybe not directly related, but when you compare Abimelech to Jesus and what people are willing to do to get Abimelech as their king, we are really bad at choosing our masters. We're terrible at choosing our masters. And so Jesus comes and shows us what it looks like. All
right. Meredith, you have a thought? Yeah, I know you have a thought to share. I know you're all thinking. I trust you're all thinking. All right, so this is the prophecy, if you will, or the foretelling of the relationship. He's very upset because Gideon, Jotham's father, Abimelech's father, had done such good for the people, and now they've turned against them and killed all the sons. And so he flees, Jotham does, and lives in Beer because of Abimelech, his brother. Now, Abimelech starts to rule and just has a heyday. I mean, for 3 years, things are looking really good. Ethan?
Yeah, I was going to say something about, I guess, what you said about, you know, how there's 70 rulers, and if Abimelech says, hey, let's have one ruler, you know, that kind of made me think about how the people of Canaan had all these different gods, and
right.
The Israelites come and say, let's have one god. But, you know, Abimelech, I guess he does it wrong.
Yeah.
But Jesus does it right.
Yeah, you being united sounds great, unless you're united under tyranny.
Yeah.
That is terrible.
Is Abimelech the first king, or would Saul be the first king?
So Abimelech is the first king in Israel, but he's not God's appointed king over Israel.
Well, he didn't rule all of Israel.
Right.
Saul.
Right. That makes sense? Abimelech's kind of a self-appointed king. All right. So Abimelech, by the way, trivia question, if someone says, who's the first king in Israel? Just say Saul. Like, don't try to argue about Abimelech. Just, if it's a trivia, it's a Bible bowl or something, Saul's the right answer. That'll get you 5 points. Abimelech will get you a weird look, okay? Saul. All right, so Abimelech, he's having a heyday for 3 years. But in verse 23, I find this fascinating. God handles it. How does he handle it? Between Abimelech and the leaders of Shechem, and the leaders of Shechem dealt treacherously with Abimelech, that the violence done to the 70 sons of Jerubbaal, might come, and their blood be laid on Abimelech their brother, who killed them, and on the men of Shechem, who strengthened his hands to kill his brothers. God is going to give justice. So whether the people of the land are going to come and give justice, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, God is going to make sure it happens. Blood was spilt, and so he's going to spill blood. And the way he accomplishes that, he doesn't send a prophet. He doesn't send a new judge. What does he do? Sends an evil spirit. Question mark. What's going on here? I don't know that we've seen this up to this point, but we're going to see some of this later. What's going on? Are there other times in the Bible story where God sends an evil spirit? Well, I say yes. Say yes, and then I'll say, when are the times when God sends an evil spirit? David?
Saul rebels against God. He takes away his spirit and then gives him the spirit.
God had given his spirit to Saul, and then when Saul disobeys, he sends an evil spirit, a distressing, jealous spirit, and Saul kind of goes nuts a little bit. Elijah?
Micaiah and Jehoshaphat and the other Israelite king.
So later in 1 Kings 22, Ahab, king of Israel in the north, okay, going back to the divided kingdom, or further the divided kingdom, and Jehoshaphat, Judah in the south, their butts, which is just one of the weirdest relationships in all the Bible. Let's just get that straight. But Ahab and Jehoshaphat are butts, and Ahab has lost Ramoth-Gilead to the east, and it's a city, and he says, hey, will you come up and fight with me? And Jehoshaphat says, well, you know, I'm with you, and you're with me, I'm as one of you. But let's hear from a man of the Lord. And so he sends for some prophets. And here come 70 prophets. And they're all going, yeah, go up. And Joshua, this is a really nice party, Ahab, but like, where's the prophet of the Lord? Well, I know one guy, his name's Micaiah. Man, I hate him. Because he never says anything good about me. Go figure. And so he sends for Micaiah, and Micaiah comes, and he reveals that God had a council in heaven with some of his heavenly beings, his spiritual messengers, and he says, look, I want to go and destroy Ahab. Who's got any ideas? And a spirit says, I'll go be a lying spirit in his prophets. And God says, go. Question mark. We're not going to solve all this today. But what we should see is that there are evil forces in the world at work today. Then, now. But who's in control of all? I don't need to understand how all of it works, but what I do need to see is that God is in control of all of it. He is king. He is the king over Israel. And so he's sending this distressing spirit to cause this animosity between Abimelech and Shechem. Politically, if someone were writing a history of this, they probably would not have said evil. Like, they would talk about all kinds of bureaucracy and financial ruin and whatever. But God's saying this, and just watch it implode. Okay? Thoughts or questions about that idea? Good. All right, so there's a fellow named Gaal, and he moves in to Shechem with his relatives. So you've got Abimelech and his relatives and Shechem. But now Gaal moves in with his relatives, and they decide that they're going to get rid of Abimelech. And so they're at this party in verse 27, this festival, and Gaal says, the son of Ebed, who is Abimelech, and who are we of Shechem, that we should serve him? Is he not the son of Jerubbaal, and is not Zebul his officer? Now Zebul is the ruler of Shechem, and so Zebul's listening to Gaal run his mouth, and Gaal says, why doesn't he come out here with his army, and we'll remove Abimelech? Come on out, we'll fight. And so what does Zebul do?
Because evil's... Go ahead.
He told.
Yeah, he's like, I'm getting tired of this Gale guy. He's eating all my food and all my drink. And now he's running his mouth on Abimelech. Go to Abimelech and tell him. And so he sets up an ambush. He says, you just wait there all night, and in the morning we'll open up the gates of the city, and you come rushing in and kill them all. Abimelech says, sounds good. So he comes in, and then the next morning, they open up the gates. And where do the leaders of the city go? They go to the gates. They go out to the gates, and as they're looking, Gale's got to kind of stretch and take stock of all he's got, and he looks sleeping there, Peter. Hey, Zebul, I think an army's coming down from the mountain. He says, no, it's just the shadows. Are you sure? Because now they're in the field. He says, oh, sure enough. Looks like Abimelech's coming here. Why don't you go out with your army and meet him? So he does. And everybody's killing everybody. And death here and death there. And so Abimelech's just cleaning things up. Abimelech decides that he wants to finish the job. So he drives out Gale and his relatives. This is verse 40. Many are wounded, many fall. And he comes through. And now he's going to continue to destroy. So he comes up to, look at verse 42. Judges 9:42. On the following day, the people went out into the field. And Abimelech was told. He took his people, divided them into three companies, set an ambush in the fields. He looked and saw the people coming out of the city. So he rose against them and killed them. He's still just killing more and more people. Two companies rush upon all who are in the field and kill them. Verse 45, Abimelech fought against the city all that day, captured the city, killed the people who were in it, and razed the city and sowed it with salt. Complete and utter destruction. And so when the leaders of Shechem hear about it, they go up into a tower. And so what does Abimelech decide to do then? Now, the way the story works, I think, is almost humorous. Abimelech says, follow me. And he cuts off a branch. He says, you see what I did? I'm like, yeah. You do it too. Okay. Where are these branches? Hold on. Let's go home. And so they go off the branches. He says, land here. Okay. Now what? And they light it on fire, burns the tower up, kills everybody in it. Wasn't that a nice, peaceful way to settle my problems? Well, there's another tower. Let's go over here. And so he comes through, and he's like, hey, we're going to do it again. Well, I know the rule this time. We did it again. We'll do it again. And who saves him?
A woman.
One of those unnamed heroes of the Bible, if you will. She's not named. But she, I don't know if she's grinding flour with it or what, and she looks down and she goes, I know what to do about this. And she tosses the millstone out, hits Abimelech, doesn't die right away, and so... what does he want to happen? He asks his soldier, you kill me so that no one will say that Abimelech died by the hands of a woman. And guess what we all say? Abimelech died by the hands of a woman. So it's just ridiculous, you know. So now, look here at verse 56. Thus God returned the evil of Abimelech, which he committed against his father in killing his 70 brothers. And God also made all the evil of the men of Shechem return on their heads, and upon them came the curse of Jotham, the son of Jeroboam. And in verse 55, everybody sees this, and they just go, well, I guess Abimelech's dead. Wonder what's on TV. And they just go back home, you know? Let's see if we can heat up leftovers and enjoy the rest of our evening, and Abimelech's dead and gone. But the passage says that God had achieved his purpose. He didn't show up with an angelic army. He didn't send a plague. It was just this animosity between people. Sin destroys sin. So, being careful of who our master is, such a crucial thing. But when there's animosity, when there's friction in relationships, I think one thing we should take away from this is you know that Satan's trying to work there. Sometimes we make conflict about you and me, and we need to remember that there are other entities who are interested in the outcome of this conflict. Satan would love to get a foothold here. Find opportunity, like Ephesians 4 says, give no opportunity to the devil. He would love to find a foothold in this and crack open something and march in with his army. We need to be appreciating what's at stake here. Right, Amos has been very patient. Yes, sir?
It seems that Jotham's parable came true because he did destroy a tower with fire.
Yes. Yeah. So all that picture's out. Noah?
Reminding you of the verse where our trouble is not against flesh and blood.
Absolutely. Yes. Even if it feels like my struggle's with this person. How does the Lord want me to go about winning? It may be by humbling myself. It may be by asking for forgiveness and confessing. It may be by laying down and accepting fault. And that's how we win. We win by being humble and letting God win. Right? Let's look at Tola and Jair. So the kingdom falls apart, and where God is in all this is he's directing things. This is question 5, answer for 10. Tola and Jair just aren't given very much in the Bible text. Verses 1 through 5, after Abimelech there arose to save Israel Tola, the son of Puah, son of Dodo, a man of Issachar. And he lived at Shamer in the hill country of Ephraim. And he judged Israel 23 years, and he died and was buried at Shamer. After him arose Jair, the Gileadite, who judged Israel 22 years. And he had 30 sons who rode on 30 donkeys. They had 30 cities called Havoth Jair to this day, which are in the land of Gilead. And Jair died and was buried in Camon. Not a lot given here, but if you were to try to appreciate why in the world does the Spirit want us to know this, what would you think?
Well, it's
kind of
demonstrating that the people went through the cycle 2 more times, that they again disobeyed, were oppressed, needed a redeemer, and repented, but then did it again.
Yes.
And did it again.
Yes. Yeah, the reason the book of Judges isn't so very long is because some of these are given us in short snippets. So you read this and go, oh, they did it again and again.
Of course, verse 1 and verse 10, and they abandoned God during the reign of these two particular judges, 45 years.
I think that's the idea. Now, I will say this, and some may differ with me on this. When it says after this, I don't think it's necessarily saying after this meaning chronologically that they are neatly up against each other, but saying, you know, after this, just in our storytelling. So here are these judges arising, sometimes at different points, and we go back to Judges 5 and see example of that with Shamgar happening at the same time with Deborah and Barak. So I think there's some overlap, but the idea is, look, let me just tell you the next part and the next part. But yeah, I think the idea is the cycle is happening again. What else do you think here? David?
And it's also just important to see, this is not like judges over the entire nation. It's right. Particular places that they're geographically located.
Yeah. Anything else? Alex?
Often we see when God is defeating an army or something, was it Gideon who had the small army?
Yeah.
And he had a small army, and we notice that it wasn't one man who did it all, but here it was one woman who defeated Abimelech.
Correct.
And then with Shamgar, the one woman, it was the one woman who defeated the king.
Oh, with Jael?
Mm-hmm.
Jael the Nail. Maybe that'll help. Always remember Jael the Nail, because... One thing to think through, and I have this in my notes, David McCauley reminded me of this for the sermon. If there were a line written about you in the Bible, what might it say? But is your name written on a line in the Book of Life? So these are real people, real stories. And they had real work to do. That's something significant, I think, to think through is I have work to do. And what does God want me to be remembered for? Maybe it's not so very significant. Maybe it's going to have huge impact. For anybody living during this time, Tola and Jair, I mean, you ask anybody on the street, who's Tola, who's Jair? They're not going to know, probably. But if you're living during this time, and you've been saved by these people, they made a huge impact. And so it may be that you're going to have a huge impact on somebody near you for the next 20 years. Do the work God's given you. Stand up. It may be that God's going to deliver somebody through you. All right, anything else? Amos?
This seems a lot like the death of Saul, where he was basically killed by the enemy, but he didn't want him to be seen like he was killed like that. So both of them asked their armor bearer to kill him.
Yeah. The sense of honor. I want to be remembered for this. If we wait till the end, we wait too long. And we have thought. All right. We'll go ahead and say a prayer and be dismissed. Next time, we will look at Judges 10 through 12. Father, thank you for this time and your word. Thank you for reminding us of the joy that it is to have a king like Jesus who put our needs before his own. May we show him honor and love and loyalty. It's in his name we pray. Amen.